Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of March. An article in the food section of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on Wednesday, March 14, caught our attention. Homegrown has a homecoming. And the author of the piece writes, "Once upon a time in Wisconsin, eating fresh and local was pretty much a fact of life. When you were here in the 19th century, probably the early part of the 20th century as well, you walked outside your door, you lived in the country, and you went to your garden, and you got the food that was in your garden, so there was no problem to eat local. It was a movement that didn't have a name, but it was the way everybody lived. We thought we would do a show on this because part of the article mentions Old World Wisconsin. And if you have been there, you know that there are gardens there from German immigrants, Polish immigrants, Irish immigrants. And the historic gardens coordinator has written a book about Wisconsin's early settlers. The book is Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers, and Marcia Carmichael is the author. And we're delighted to have Marcia with us as we talk about these gardens. And we're thinking early this year about gardens because, for heaven's sake, the daffodils came up in the last couple days. I will have to ask her about what that does to crops to have such a darned early spring. She is the historical gardener at the 576-acre Old World Wisconsin. It's the largest of the Wisconsin Historical Society's living history museums. She exercises her passion for historical accuracy and enjoys the research as much as the design, creation, and nurturing of the museum's heritage gardens. She also, before this job, owned and operated her own greenhouses and herb business. She has received many awards from the Herb Society of America, Waukesha County Technical Institute, Milwaukee Magazine, and she works alongside a dedicated group of historical garden volunteers to create the period-appropriate gardens. I'm sure some of you will have questions about the kinds of crops that were grown, and you may have stories about your ancestors who came to Wisconsin and the gardens that they created, the flowers that and herbs that went with certain kind of vegetables, what grew here, what didn't grow here. We'll welcome your phone calls, and I would imagine we'll have more than a few. The number is 800-486-8655. And if you want to make this a complete event, the book also has heirloom plants that you can grow and also 19th century recipes. So you can think about a 19th century recipe. That'd be fun, huh? Marcia, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to have some fun this hour.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. I hope so.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. The first thing I must ask you is, no matter what your garden is, if you have an heirloom garden, a German immigrant garden, or whatever it is, what in the world is going on with the weather? And are we to be concerned that maybe some of the things that we've planted are going to freeze again, or are the daffodils are going to go away, or some of the trees that we have planted? What's going on?
Isn't this crazy?
Yeah.
In our lifetime, we'll probably never see anything like this again. Boy, you mentioned daffodils, and on my way into work this morning, the daffodils are blooming. Yeah, it's just incredible. So many of these early plants are tough, you know, and they'll withstand considerable drops in temperature that I imagine we're going to see. But, boy, it's a gamble, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. Are you worried about any of the gardens at Old World Wisconsin?
Well, I've been out taking a peek, and there's sure a lot of things that are leafing out and budding out, and I'm trying to have a word with them and calm them down and tell them, you know, here's the calendar, it's only March, settle down, but I guess it'll be what it will be.
Maybe you need to sing that to them.
There you have it. And if only they would listen, right?
If only they would. So you have gardens from what immigrants? German, Polish, Irish, others?
Norwegian, Finnish, Danish, what have we missed? Seven different ethnic groups. Yankees, people who came originally from the British Isles and then settled in the northeastern part of the United States and then kind of migrated west. We have, farm gardens, some village gardens. So, a really nice variety of things to look at.
Are people paying more attention to your gardens with this whole eat locally movement sprouting?
Oh, I think absolutely. And more coming out to look at the gardens and get ideas for home.
Yes.
You know, it's not just the education part, but it's, I could do that.
And how much knowledge did all of these immigrants have that maybe we forgot for a while because we forgot where vegetables came from? How much wisdom did they have that we need to resurrect?
Well, since they depended on these plants to live, they brought as much information as they could have gathered and passed down through their generations in their homeland, and then brought it with them and passed it on, to the next generation here. So hopefully we haven't lost all of that. I know sometimes when the school groups come out and children visit, they're meeting some plants and vegetables for the first time, and it's always kind of exciting, to say, it doesn't just come in a frozen packet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Did they bring seeds from their
home? They did. We have great references to people bringing seeds and tubers and cuttings and even small pieces of rose bushes from home, and then these things traveled across the country in the early years by covered wagon. It's just incredible how people knew that they were going to need these plants to survive, and some of them also were, they brought them because they were a piece of home, that they could
sure.
hopefully plant in the new world and then have that connection, not knowing if they'd ever get back and see family that had remained behind. So it's really special to be able to kind of speak to each ethnic group and, go with what their character is and what some of their favorite plants were. And it's just, we work really hard to make each garden be an individual representation of in the family and their ethnic background and the time period that the building is set up for. So there's a lot to learn.
And what could be more meaningful to an immigrant than to bring something that you could plant in your homeland? Then it becomes so much more like home, right?
Right, exactly. And then to know how to propagate that so you could pass it on to family here, as the generations go along. And also their methods of planting and their designs of their gardens varied depending on where they had come from and what the traditions were. And interestingly, the longer they stayed here, the more homogeneous gardens sort of took on a look that was a typical American look over the years. So it's kind of fun to go back and see what the earlier styles were from their homeland and to recreate those and find that those are circling around and becoming popular again.
A lot of the farms that you illustrate so beautifully in your book, the gardens also have flowers. It was important, I would think, for almost all of these immigrant groups to do a combination.
Almost all. We find that the northern Scandinavians were not as, didn't do as many flowers in their gardens, but we know that they were sort of like the Norwegian women, for instance, didn't put a lot of flowers in the garden, but we knew they traded cuttings and did potted plants, so they still loved their blooming things, but they wanted to have more utilitarian gardens. But so many of the others, yes, mixed flowers and herbs right in with the vegetables, so it creates these visions of beauty as well as just interest.
Mm-hmm. You have some great pictures of the potted plants inside some of these homes. A whole wall with a window will be completely filled with potted plants. It's beautiful.
Right. Isn't that fun? And to think that people in the 19th century really, spent a lot of time developing the interiors of their houses, especially the Yankee women just took great pride in the garden they could create in their own parlor.
Did everybody grow pretty much the same thing because they were in Wisconsin?
Well, we know that everybody grew some of the same root crops. So if you can adjust your palate to a lot of potatoes and onions and turnips and rutabagas and carrots and beets, lots of root crops, we know that almost everybody was growing those because they could survive on those, and those were things that would do well in this climate, no matter which part of the state you were in. And then they would store well for winter so that the family could be fed year-round. And then depending on what your background was and what your comfort foods were, different other plants then were also grown.
Mm-hmm. What about herbs?
We find that dill and caraway and parsley were pretty much universal. Also, they did well in Wisconsin. Could come on to make a product in pretty short order. The caraway, you had to wait the second year to get the seed, but in Europe they had loved their caraway seed and so many things that they brought that with them and found that it withstood our winters and everything. And those were pretty much common. Other herbs depended on what their background was. So if they were used to a certain flavor, they brought the seeds or they brought a little piece of it and then continued to grow it or wrote a letter back to the old country and said, hey, you know, could you send me some of these? Or if you're coming over, could you bring some, you know, because I can't find it in America, you know. So kind of interesting. And that's of course, where different ethnic dishes get different flavors depending on what herbs are used as well as what vegetables and fruits.
Hmm. My mother used to make me eat parsley. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a kid, come on. She said, no, this is one of the best things that you can eat. And lo and behold, many years later, she's gone. But I buy parsley and I grow parsley now and eat my parsley. I'm not sure how good it is for you, but that must have come from her background somewhere.
Yeah, and everybody grew parsley, and it was grown for its flavor, you know, and grew really, really well here. And there's a root variety of parsley, so the entire plant's edible. You can eat the below ground as well as the above ground.
Really?
Yeah. And what I had found was really interesting was I always thought that it was the flat leaf Italian parsley probably was, you know, the one that everybody grew. And come to find out that in the 19th century, they were working hard to make the leaves as curled as possible because then parsley could be in the front of the garden because it would be attractive. So they also recognized the value of having something really pretty up front. So the more, and then there were tips on how to keep your parsley from reverting back to that plain old flat leaf stuff, you know, so you could grow the pretty. So kind of fun.
Huh. How much work was it to be able to, it must have been a whole lot of work. You had to feed your family from what was outside. Did people have to tend to their gardens hours and hours and hours a day, or did they come up with ways that made it easier?
Well, they worked on finding ways that made it easier, but certainly a lot of time was devoted. This was, the kitchen gardens were the kind of the domain of the housewife or the farm wife, and she had to put in as much time as was necessary to create, you know, to find something that was, you know, make the crops grow well enough that she could support the family. And not only was it food, but in the early years, they also grew plants for medicine and dye plants and things for fragrance, you know, whatever was needed in the household. When the children were young, they also were expected to help in the kitchen gardens. We find that the men of the house often helped in the early spring with turning over the ground, composting, you know, adding manure to the beds. And then pretty much they were out doing field work or off to their other jobs, and it was left to the ladies. And when the boys were old enough to help Dad out in the fields, then they left and weren't helping Mom anymore in the kitchen garden either. So depend on the daughters until they went off to find other work or moved out, and then it was still the housewife's domain.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your work in the gardens at Old World Wisconsin and the volunteer gardeners. It must be quite a lot of work to keep all those gardens blooming.
It is a lot of work. I work with an incredible group of people. They're people who come out and play in the gardens with me do it because we all love it. And we're able to learn from one another. We're able to share information with the visitors or the guests who come out and see the gardens, and we learn from them as well. So it's, you know, it is a lot of work, but it's very rewarding. It's just, we're constantly learning things and sharing information. So it's pretty incredible.
Do you eat the food?
We have interpreters in the homes who are in period dress, as the gardeners are. And the people in the houses generally are the ones who harvest the food, harvest the crops, and cook in the houses on the old cook stoves.
Mm-hmm.
And we use some of the food for special events. The gardeners tend to not nibble so much because, you know, we're open till the end of October, so we don't want to deplete the supply too much.
Right. I love the instructions in your book. You're even told what you should wear to garden, what kind of dress it should be, and definitely how important the hat is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, to be, you know, out there properly attired in the garden, it's a good idea to wear a bonnet or a hat, something to keep the sun off the face, because people in the 1800s weren't interested in acquiring a tan. That would look like you had to be out working in the
mm-hmm.
garden.
Yeah. Right.
And we are pretty careful about, you know, that the clothing is right, so we have the right look. So it gives the right ambiance, it gives the right view when people come out to visit. So they get an idea of what their ancestors really had to go through in order to create these gardens.
Marcia Carmichael, our guest this hour, we're talking about really eating locally and how people did that, the immigrants who came here. Wonderful pictures in her book and also a lot of recipes looking at the waves of immigrants that came to Wisconsin, the Norwegians, the Finnish, the Danish, the Irish, the Germans, the Polish people, and the Yankees who came here as well. Our number is 800, and Native Americans, 800-486, they were here first, of course, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. So we'll be with you momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, John Farrell, the author of Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. He was a practicing defense lawyer in his time, represented gangsters, psychopaths, gamblers, bank robbers, drunk drivers, rum runners, yellow journalists, union goons, crooked politicians, greedy corporations, and many a scorned woman like Emma Thompson, the socialite who smuggled a handgun into court and shot her philandering husband in the midst of their divorce proceeding. "You've killed him," said a shocked clerk. "I hope so," said Emma. Darrow convinced the jury to have mercy on the widow. He was a remarkable lawyer, so we'll learn more about Clarence Darrow tomorrow during this hour. All right, two phone calls. We have tons of them. Our guest is Marcia Carmichael. She is the Historic Gardens Coordinator, Master Historic Gardener herself at Old World Wisconsin. Maddie in Waupaca is our first caller. Hi, Maddie.
I was wondering what all American Indians grew. I once read that 4 out of every $7 earned by agriculture is earned on a crop developed by American Indians. And I know that the Oneidas, when they came from New York, they brought corn, beans, and squash, among other things. But I wondered about potatoes, sweet potatoes, pumpkins, squash, hot and sweet peppers, wax and green beans.
Certainly. They did grow potatoes. We know that those were a number of the Native American tribes were growing potatoes and sharing them. So they were here for a long time. A lot of different varieties of squash and pumpkins and beans, as you mentioned. And I can't remember what else you said, but I don't have a lot of research completed on the Native Americans, so I can't, you know, I'm not sure your best authority on that, but certainly many, many different crops were grown here, and they were sharing. The Native Americans left, you know, fairly early 1830s, roughly, when they were starting to move out of the Wisconsin area. So when some of these immigrants came in, the Native Americans had already moved on or were being sort of confined and moved over. But they did have influences on the people who came in, and those who still lived here were sharing some of their plants with the early European settlers.
Thanks, Maddie, so much for your call. We go to Nancy somewhere on Highway 41. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm so glad I caught this show. I've been to Old World, Wisconsin many, many times. My family is from North Dakota and Upper Minnesota area, and they originally came through France to French Quebec and then settled in northern Minnesota, and we always had rhubarb. I was wondering if you knew the history of rhubarb and how it played. We had, you know, I have like 100 different recipes for rhubarb.
Right. Rhubarb originated in Asia, but it did come over quite early and came with a number of the different Europeans because it was a plant that did extremely well, comes up so early, and offers lots of possibilities for recipes. We know it's very healthful in limited amounts, but because it's one of the early crops, really, really valuable. It's interesting that as we read about recipes as they developed for things like rhubarb pie and desserts with rhubarb, that they were considered by some of the groups fairly special, because although they could grow the rhubarb, the sugar or the sweetener cost a lot of money. So it became a little more of a treat to have rhubarb pie than you normally might think of when you think of how easily it grows here. And when you mentioned your French background, the people from France and Italy brought so many more very interesting varieties of plant material when they came over, and those influenced the gardens as well. So really interesting background.
Hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Did people have greenhouses, or did they use ways to get the seeds going inside the house in some way?
There were commercial nurseries in some of the towns that people might have been able to purchase plants from, but the common people were much more apt to have cold frames and hotbeds where they'd put in horse manure to heat up the soil, and that would be like running on propagating mat, and then put glass over the top to try and, you know, capture the heat as the plant material was germinating. So they were pretty inventive in whatever was needed, because, things like tomatoes, when they became popular, and a number of the other plants, need a longer growing season than we can offer. So if they could be started ahead, then, you know, rare to have a season like the one we're having now. So the longer that you can extend the season, the more welcome it was. So peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, that sort of thing that needs a early heat, they definitely were learning how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty. Oh, Betty, you're gone. Let's go to Joy in West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. I had one question. I thought of a couple while I'm waiting. I've been to Old World, Wisconsin, and seen apple cider vinegar in a barrel, and I'm just wondering, is that just apples? Do you add any water? How that's made? Then I also wanted to hear about flax. Did they eat the seeds as well as make linen? And then I thought about also wild things like nettles, and somebody once told me that ragweed makes a wonderful fiber.
Hmm.
Oh, interesting. Well, you're just full of good questions. The apple cider vinegar, it is made from apples with water, and I'm not sure what else. I personally have not made it, so I guess we'll need to do a little more experimenting or check with our food waste person on that. The flax was grown for its fiber and for the seeds to be pressed for oil. So at this time, I don't have any references that talk about eating the flax seed. So it had other uses, but certainly was grown and was very popular because it was a fiber that could be then spun and made into fabric. And the wild, what we would think of as weeds, the nettles had a lot of value medicinally. I don't find much reference to them being used that's put down in print that's anything I've come across. I haven't come across ragweed at all mentioned in the 19th century literature, so I'm not sure when that was when that made its way into Wisconsin. So I don't really know. And I also have heard that it has a fiber that could be useful if we have to go in that direction.
Hmm. Thank you, Joy, for the call. I've always wondered, when you look at the number of natural things, and, well, most of our drugs come from natural things, what process of experimentation and how dangerous it was to experiment with a lot of those things in your garden to see if they were effective as medicines. There must have been some mishaps, right? Because not all of that would be good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would hope that people were keeping careful records of what they had used and tried and then passed that information on. So certainly as things were tried and either positive results or not so good, best to know which one it was that was used, learn how to identify that plant, and then, you know, proceed accordingly. But certainly records were kept going back thousands of years to make sure that that kind of thing was closely followed.
Right. Susan in Oregon. Hi, Susan.
Hi. When I was a child, my grandparents were living up north in northern Wisconsin, and they were from Bohemian and German heritage. And the farmers in that area all grew just rows and rows of poppies. And I can remember the poppy harvest where my grandmother had sheets laid out on the ground, and she had all these poppy heads that she'd be drying out on these sheets and then cutting the tops off with a paring knife and gathering all those seeds. But it seems as though you don't see that much growth of poppies anymore. And I hear that when you buy poppy seed, it's already been heated in such a way that it doesn't germinate anymore. And I think because of the relation to drug trafficking, I think that might be related to the difficulty in getting poppy seeds for the garden. Do you have any comments on that? I would like to grow poppy seed just because of the memories of that.
There are seed catalogs that still grow or still offer seed to grow what they call bread seed poppies, so that you can raise your poppies and collect the seed as your relations did. And what a beautiful vision that must have been.
Oh, it must have. I saw it in my mind's eye as she was talking.
Yeah, incredible. And so many of the people who came over from Europe had grown poppies, and they had collected them even from the wild as well as put them in their gardens. I went out in December thinking that I was, you know, sneaking out kind of lucky with the weather, and seeded some poppies this year in our Polish garden, thinking that it would create the right look and it would be lovely. So we'll see what happens. But I would think just start looking through your seed catalogs, and you should be able to find some. They're not as prevalent as they might have been before the big drug thing. But I would definitely try and put some in because they're so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Susan, for the call. Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple questions. One's regarding seeds. Seems like the seeds now that I plant, I have a big garden and I can. But when I was a kid growing up, the flavor just seemed to be more so in the vegetables than they are now. One of the things is like watermelon and muskmelon. Now, someone said those seeds are coming in now from China.
Oh, that's interesting. Some of the seed companies will put right on the seed or right on the package where the seed originates, and you might be able to look at those and test that out. I would just try different varieties. There are so many different varieties of watermelon and cantaloupe, and a lot of the old-fashioned flavors really are, the old-fashioned varieties do have a lot of flavor, and I would just, you know, talk to your friends and do a little bit of research and try different ones. Of course, the weather is influences the flavor as well. So if we get another hot, dry summer, it's usually pretty good melon weather for developing the sweetness and the flavor that you might remember.
Do you grow watermelons at Old World?
We do. We grow a couple of old-time varieties and a couple of cantaloupe varieties as well. And then we grow a really sweet little, tiny little kind of fist-sized melon that's called a Queen Anne's pocket melon that's grown for its fragrance rather than its flavor. But that's also a lot of fun to have in the garden.
But I've had a lot of problems growing cantaloupes. I've only tried twice, but they were awful.
Oh, maybe try a different area of the garden or hope for better weather.
Is that it? It was weather, huh?
Sometimes it can be weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, too cool and too much rain, and they're not real pleased with that.
Mm-hmm. Betty, thanks for the call. We have lines open, and they've been very crowded. If you'd like to join the conversation, our guest this hour is Marcia Carmichael. She is the author of a lovely book, Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers, and she is the historical gardener at the 576-acre Old World, Wisconsin. We were captivated by an article in the Journal Sentinel a couple weeks ago. Maybe, no, it was just last week, about when eating local meant going outside your house and going to your garden and, getting the food that you had planted. You know, it's in my mind as we're talking the whole time here too, Marcia, that you had to do this. You had to know this in order to survive. We just take this for granted now, and you think about the pressure was on so you could feed your family.
That's exactly right. It wasn't an option, and it wasn't just a popular trend, something to do. This was vital.
We go to Kathy in Genoa City next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Good.
Thank you. I wanted to tell Marcia that we had come to the garden last year to Old World on her Sunday in the garden.
Oh, thank you. Good.
Yes. And we came two consecutive Sundays. We had such a good time the first time. And we wondered if you were going to do that again this year.
Oh, yes, and thank you for asking. We've expanded the garden walks a little bit. This year we're going to have, on four different days, we're going to have some before and after hours garden strolls, and then we'll be serving refreshments. So it will be 2 hours, or two different gardens, a 2.5-hour time period.
Oh, nice.
And so we really get a chance to do a little more in-depth, and then we'll have refreshments from those ethnic groups of the gardens we visit.
Oh, great.
Oh, how fun. Well, I wanted to tell you this also. As we speak, my husband is out in our front yard vegetable garden putting down his 4x4 frame.
Oh.
Oh, bless his heart.
Because he loved that German front yard garden that we saw.
Fabulous. Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we're very excited about it, and we can't wait to start putting those seeds in the ground.
Oh, how wonderful, and what a great day to be out doing that.
I know, isn't it? Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. See, you're a source of inspiration for a lot of people. That's good to hear, Marcia, isn't it?
Well, it's neat. Some of these gardens are so attractive, and they're not humongous, so people can get a handle on that and think, I can go home and I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's neat, yeah.
Here's a call from Michael, who has a small organic farm in Wisconsin. In Luck, Wisconsin, he's having a lot of trouble with potato bugs. They've tried using organic sprays from Germany and moving the plants, but they keep coming back and ruining the crops. Any ideas for him? And the broader question is, how did people who were immigrants in the 19th century deal with these kinds of problems?
They are a huge problem, and the Colorado potato beetle has been in Wisconsin far too long. It was here when people were arriving in the 19th century. It's interesting that when I'm reading through the old periodicals in the 1870s and 80s, letters started to show up to the editor that people were finding they could interplant petunias with potatoes and that they would repel the Colorado potato beetle. And the letters went on for about 20 years that it was advised that people could do that. So we do that in some of our gardens.
Hmm.
Originally, the reports were that it was white petunias, and these are very old-fashioned varieties, of course, that date back to 1830, 1840, and we've tried it. I can't tell for sure if it's the effect of the petunia that is repelling the potato beetle or if we're just lucky in that particular garden, but as Michael does, we rotate the crops around. We scout for any eggs that we find on the leaves. We try and destroy those. 19th century, the folks eventually were learning about poisons and thought that they had it made because things with arsenic in started to become available. And before they realized how dangerous they were, people were using those sorts of chemicals to kill off the bugs, and it was miraculous. You know, it was working, and then they realized, oh, maybe not so good.
Yeah, yeah.
But it took some time. But they're a constant problem, and I can sure commiserate with Michael, and I don't have any great ideas. He can certainly try putting petunias in with the potatoes because when the potatoes die back, you've still got the really pretty flowers on as well. So it sort of gives you a lift. And hopefully he can get back to me and report if that works at all for him.
How in the world, of all the flowers in the world, Marcia, how in the world would you know that a white petunia next to your potatoes might do the trick?
Isn't that interesting? I suppose it's just different combinations were put together, and then people saw that those potatoes weren't being bothered by the bugs, and that's how we learn, and you keep trying We've also put in multicolored vining petunias, and those are maybe not quite as effective as the white ones for us, but interesting to try. And different plants, this is what companion planting is all about. Some plants will work really well together with other plants, and some will repel certain pests or critters. It's just something that's learned, and then if you learn a trick that works, you pass it on and hope that everybody can benefit from it.
Marcia Carmichael is our guest this hour. We're talking about eating locally. When eating locally was walking out your back door or your front door, as is the case for many of these gardens, and eating what you planted in your garden. She is the author of Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. She's the historical gardener at Old World Wisconsin. And we're welcoming phone calls for her. We also have a lot of emails that have come in. But if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. The overall theme of the conversation is, as we contemplate and try to live eating locally in 2012, what can we learn from people who did this in 1883, to pick a date? 800-486-8655. We'll be back with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to a couple of emails. This one is from Judy. My parents had 8 children and a massive garden. We are Germans, and our gardens included the usual vegetables, but also kohlrabi and ground cherries. My mother made jam out of anything, it seems, including rhubarb. Ground cherries, any berries, etc. I've planted cherries in the past and was delighted when they returned the following year. I still love them and hope to delight my grandchildren with unwrapping the tissue paper thin skin once they are ripe. My grandchildren were less than thrilled. I'm sorry to say they were skeptical and afraid to taste. I just thought I'd add ground cherries to the discussion, and I'm glad she did. How about ground cherries?
Oh, they're wonderful. And I would suggest that she try growing them again and reintroduce the kids to them. They can be made into jams like her mother did, and they can be eaten like candy. They're just great fun. And they can be juiced. You can make pie out of them. Try different things. They're fairly low-growing plants, and they look a little bit like Chinese lanterns. So that there's this, like she describes, this papery cover, and you peel it off when they're ripe, and you have this golden cherry inside that's sort of a combination of tomato cherry flavor. It's slightly tart but slightly sweet, and it's a blast when you're out in the garden.
It sounds great. Yeah. How do you keep, this is from Jeanette, how do you keep deer, rabbits, and squirrels away from the gardens, especially being near the Kettle Moraine Forest?
Well, early settlers believed in fences, and they believed in high fences for good reason, to keep the animals out. We do have all of those animals out here, plus a number of others, and sometimes they just come in anyway. My argument with them is, we have 576 acres. You get out there and eat something outside the fences. Sometimes that works and sometimes not. When it comes to rabbits, we have gray Santalina plants are pretty good repellents for the rabbits. So if we plant a couple of those around, usually that works pretty well. The deer, right now we're sharing, but fortunately there is other acreage they can eat off of. So,
Joanne in Princeton, hi.
Oh, hello.
Hi,
are you there?
Yeah, we're here. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just had a comment about trying to keep the potato bugs off your potatoes. I plant Nicotina, which I think is that wild tobacco plant, the old-fashioned tobacco flowering. Yeah, you plant that in amongst your potatoes, and what happens is the potato bugs naturally attract to that because it's potatoes and tomatoes and all that eggplant are all from the tobacco family, and they attract to that original wild tobacco flowering plant, and they don't lay eggs on the potatoes. They lay eggs, and they will eat the Nicotina, but not your potatoes.
Very interesting. And there are so many varieties of Nicotiana now that are available, or flowering tobacco, so you can grow tall ones, short ones, and they're often fragrant flowers. So
yes,
something really nice to try, and they'd be nice kind of off to the side, so they would pull the potato bugs maybe away from the potato crop. That's really a neat idea. Thank you for sharing
that.
Yeah,
give it a try.
Yeah, thanks, Joanne, so much for the call. Let's go to Pat in Appleton. Hi, Pat.
Yes, hello. When I was a child, my grandma used to make some sort of potions for people came to her for all kinds of things, and we had to go and pick knotweed or knockweed, from my understanding, is what it was called. Have you any idea what medicinal purposes that was used for?
Boy, with that common name, I really don't recognize what it might be.
It was a real low-growing, crawly. In fact, I still have it some in my yard. And that's all I ever knew it by, and nothing was ever written down. So I was kind of wondering.
And have you tasted it?
I was fairly young when this happened, and she died. I was still just a child. Mm. So
was it ingested?
I always remember, us going out and doing that along with chamomile tea, we were drying that.
Yeah. What do you remember? How the knotweed was taken? Was it put on?
I almost think it was in like a tea form.
Okay. Boy, I'll have to look into that a little bit further. I don't know offhand, but very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you, Pat, very much for the call. An email from Mary. Could you speak of older, more unknown vegetables like, I've never heard of some of these, salsify, burdock, and skirret?
Yes.
What are they, and how are they used, and how do they taste?
Salsify and scorzonera are two different kind of what were thought of as oyster vegetables. So they tasted a little bit like oysters.
Ooh.
And can still be grown. Oysters were a popular flavor during the time period we're talking about.
Huh.
So if you could grow that in your garden, how cool was that?
I don't know. I guess it was cool. It doesn't sound cool to me, but it was cool.
They're root vegetables.
Yeah.
And they could be scrubbed up and cooked up. And then the trick was to try and create the dish that would make them look the most like oysters so that you could fool your guests. So if you're into serving oysters, that's what the salsify is all about.
Huh.
I don't find much reference to using burdock root. I know it's highly medicinal value. It's an interesting plant, but I don't find that was very often, at least it wasn't recorded that people were using or eating that. And what was the other one she asked about?
Skirret?
Skirret.
Skirret.
Skirret had fallen out of fashion by the, in our area at least, by the mid-1800s. It was popular in the Northeast in the previous couple of centuries. And that's another root vegetable. Also has leaves, edible leaves. Another one of those interesting things that did really well. Mediocre flavor, which is probably why it's not real popular
right. These
days.
Yeah. Linda in Iron Belt. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm coming down there in June-ish, and are you putting on a show, or not a show, but doing a presentation down in Old World?
We have assorted special events. If you go to the website, oldworldwisconsin.org, you can see what the calendar is of events.
Okay. But are you going to be there?
I'm always here.
Oh.
I'm here much more than I'm home.
Okay, are you going to be there around June, 10th or 23rd, when the other lady comes in with her book?
When who comes in?
It's the lady that wrote the books on Old World Wisconsin.
The Kathleen Ernst,
yes.
And the Old World Murder, and those
yes.
Those books. Okay, I may be in the gardens that day, but I won't. I'm not doing a presentation at that time.
Okay, so when are you doing presentations down there? Will they be on the website?
Yes, and you can also look at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press website, and
okay.
They would have various speaking engagements that I will be doing.
Great.
But then our garden strolls are the best way to really nail me down that I'll be out here in the garden.
Right. Just go find her in the garden.
Yeah. And bring
love
a
that.
Shovel.
And bring your shovel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. She really wants to track you down.
And when people come to visit, we do usually have extra tools on hand. They're welcome to join us. You know,
you can use the help, I'm sure. Thanks, Linda. Mary in Eau Claire, hi.
Excuse me. Hi, I had a couple questions here. My ancestors came from the Alsace, and they all planted red runner beans and had grape arbors. My second question is, they had elaborate systems of root cellars and stuff for putting food by. I mean, it wasn't just like walking out in your garden. You
right.
had to make it last. And if you know how to make beets last longer, I would love to know that.
Oh, we haven't talked about beets.
And third, we haven't talked about grains, which was a lot of what they lived off of.
Mm-hmm.
And number four, and last, my Aunt Emma used mullein, an infusion of mullein for sprains. It surprised my grandmother when it worked.
Marcia.
Okay, let's see if we can go back. Runner beans and grape arbors we started with, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very popular. The grapes were something that people depended on for jams and jellies and juices and wines and, you know, what all. Just even eating table grapes as well. And a number of people did put up grape arbors to grow them on. And they didn't have to be elaborate, just something simple, but a place for the vines to climb. And they were highly valued. They brought European varieties of grapes over and found that the native grapes actually did a whole lot better and were stronger. So there was a lot of hybridization of grape varieties that went on. Runner beans were popular. They're attractive. They're tasty. So absolutely grow them. What else? Root cellars and ways of keeping food over winter. Very, very popular. Those who could put in a root cellar did, but if they couldn't do that, often they just dug pits in the ground or buried barrels in the ground with vegetables and, you know, various things inside and carefully layered and the right amount of airspace or packed in soil, depending on what the plant was, to keep them going. So a number of the root vegetables could be packed in you know, in soil or compost so that they didn't touch each other, but that would keep them going a while longer. If you wanted to collect seed off of a biennial like a beet that was more or less planted in some soil and then put in the cellar or in the buried in the ground for the wintertime and then dug back up and try and get it to go to seed so you would have, you know, seed to plant your next crops. What else?
What about grain?
Grains were, as she said, very, very popular and very important
mm-hmm.
to survival, and they weren't grown by the housewife, but that was the farmer's domain. So he was out there with either hand plows or oxen, horses, whatever they had to grow what they were comfortable with, what they were used to.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mary. Ed in Wausau. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that my grandfather, I lived at 918 Regent Street when my dad was away in the Army. But he had the only peach tree, my grandfather, that grew in Madison. And it was at 1918 Regent Street. The building still stands.
Oh.
And it's only like one business removed from the Italian Workmen's Club, and which is still in operation. But his side business was he also had a still, which supplied the Italian Workmen's Club with booze. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. He also always had roses growing in front of his house.
Oh, we didn't talk about roses. Roses were a big thing, yeah.
roses were a big thing, right? Oh, what an interesting past your family has.
It's documented in a book called A Taste of Memories from the Old Bush. But it was, I think volumes might be still available.
I'm making a note of that. Thank you so much for sharing that information.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks so much for the call. We don't have time. I was going to do it, but then I'll just be sorry I did, so I won't. Marcia, thank you so much. What gardening task do you have today?
Oh, goodness. I'm checking on the baby seedlings and seeing how they're hatching in the greenhouse.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love that job for today. What a nice thing to think about. That's my job for today. How are the baby seedlings doing?
Life is good.
Life is really good, and maybe you could sing to them.
Yeah, maybe I could.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a couple of years
since I've been out to Old World, Wisconsin. I'll have to do that this summer.
That would be lovely. Thank
you. And track you down in the garden, Marcia.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Marcia Carmichael. She has a lovely book, too. It's Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. She is the historic gardener at the Old World Wisconsin, 576-acre, the largest of Wisconsin Historical Society's living history museums. And we thought about all of this, actually, thanks to an article which you may want to look up in the Journal Sentinel from March 14th last week. Homegrown has a homecoming. It was like when eating locally meant what was outside the front door or the back door. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.